For thousands of years, tribes of people inhabited the Four Corner area of the American Southwest. It remains a great mystery why, in the 14th century, these ancient people suddenly seemed to vanish, abandoning their homes. But they left behind a trove of archaeological evidence, including baskets, granaries, arrowheads, gravesites, and drawings. The challenge now is to figure out what all of it means and if we can use these objects to piece together that lost history. Joining us on today's Please Explain is David Roberts, a veteran mountain climber and a scholar of the American Southwest. His latest book is The Lost World of the Old Ones, Discoveries in the Ancient Southwest. It's published by W.W. Norton. Very pleased to welcome him back to our show. And if anyone out there has a question about the ancient American Southwest, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page on Facebook or on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. David, the book is a follow-up to your 1996 book, In Search of the Old Ones. Why did you return to the subject in your writing again?
Well, this is really the first and only sequel I've written. And the simple reason is that, unlike most book subjects, the prehistoric Southwest really got under my skin, and I couldn't let go of it after that first book. I've gone back to the Southwest every spring and fall since 96, and I realized I'd learned so much since I wrote the first book that I simply had to follow it up with more accounts of more adventures and more research from the latest work of the very best archaeologists.
So the archaeologists are learning new things about these people who used to be called the Anasazi.
Yes, we aren't allowed to call them Anasazi anymore for various politically correct reasons, but we're now supposed to call them the ancestral Puebloans, a term I hate, but have grudgingly succumbed to.
Well, Anasazi was actually a negative term that the Navajos applied to the people who they never met, but who they assumed had lived in these buildings that they came upon when they moved into the area.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really a negative term. It's simply that the PC scholars have decreed a negative term. It's a Navajo word that means something like ancient enemies or enemies of our ancestors. And it's full of sort of a mystical overtone. And I think it's a great word, but it's taboo anymore.
You pay a lot of attention to the Fremont people in your book. Who were they and where did they live?
Yeah, I mean, actually, ancestral Puebloans does not apply to the surrounding peoples, including, especially in this book, the Fremont, who were the northern neighbors of the ancestral Puebloans. They occupied most of Utah and were contemporary with what we used to call the Anasazi, flourishing for several thousand years until, likewise, a sudden disappearance in the 13th century, end of the 13th, beginning of the 14th. But they're quite distinct from the folks farther south, much more marginalized because it's so hard to grow corn up north, and much less well understood today, which is part of what intrigued me in trying to prowl through their canyons and learn more about the Fremont.
Did they also live in cliff dwellings and the same sorts of things that I'm going to still use the word Anasazi, that this so-called Anasazi lived in?
The Fremont were necessarily much less sedentary, and so they don't have the spectacular cliff dwellings such as you find at Mesa Verde, but they did indeed live in cliffs and especially store their corn and their grain and their beans and squash in granaries that are, you know, hundreds of feet up wildly vertical and overhanging cliffs. On the other hand, they were much more semi-nomadic throughout their long, long reign in the Southwest, and therefore much harder to find archaeologically.
Now, there's an amazing site called Pueblo Bonito that includes quite sophisticated masonry, buildings of two stories, and it's not in a cliff. It's on the ground, and it's joined by a web of roadways. Why did these people later move into cliff dwellings? Do we know?
Well, you're speaking of Chaco Canyon, which was the most magnificent and the most sophisticated development in all of the prehistoric Southwest between about 1000 AD and 1125 in this desolate little canyon in western New Mexico. And as you point out, such magnificent buildings as Pueblo Benito were not built in the cliffs. We pretty much think that the move to the cliffs occupied mostly the 13th century and mostly the really desperate times before the abandonment. In other words, they're defensive. They're afraid of somebody, probably other Anasazi, and so they have to hide in more and more difficult, scary places to get to just to save their own lives and their food.
But it's hard to get up to those cliff dwellings.
Oh, yeah, and that's what appeals to me as a climber. The archaeologists tend to ignore the accomplishment of the Anasazi as climbers, and yet it's phenomenal. They were really, really gifted and virtuosic and pretty crazy.
Well, I've been to many of the sites, and one of the things you notice is that there are these finger and toe holes that are on the walls that lead up to the cliffs. But I can't imagine that everybody was able to get up there that way.
Well, picture the grandparents and the babies trying to get up there. And yet there's good evidence that those really dangerous, difficult, scary dwellings were lived in with the elderly and the infants as well as the those in the prime of life.
How long had these groups been in the area? I'm assuming that they originally weren't not even living on the level ground, that they were digging holes and living in that, and then started building on the ground and then eventually went up to the cliffs. That would have been a process that lasted thousands of years.
Well, of course, before they're sedentary at all, they're purely nomadic. And in what we call the archaic period, before, let's say, 1500 B.C., they're almost completely nomadic. They are building granaries and storage cysts to store their goodies, their food. But they're not building homes until they enter the basket maker stage in around the time of Christ or just before.
And were they also engaging in agriculture?
Oh, yes. They got corn by probably 500, 700 A.D., and it totally transformed their culture so that by the end, just before the abandonment, they're completely agrarian, and which allows, it's an old cliche, that if you're a sedentary people, you can build beautiful buildings and do great artwork. And the nomads don't tend to leave nearly as much of a fingerprint to reveal their civilization.
Isn't there still a mystery as to what led them to simply leave, to leave everything and go off? Don't most historians assume it was because of a prolonged drought or a breakdown of their belief systems because of the drought or, as you mentioned earlier, attacks by other groups?
We know that there was a terrible drought from 1276 to 1299 A.D. It's possible it didn't rain for 24 years. But
sounds like today.
Pardon?
Sounds like California today.
Yeah, right, exactly. There are all kinds of environmental factors. There's drought, there's the hunting out of the big game, there's deforestation because they probably cut down most of the trees both for building and for firewood. But the old theory that alone triggered the abandonment doesn't wash because they survived even worse droughts in earlier centuries. And so that more and more archaeologists and anthropologists are looking for a cultural reason. And in fact, the Hopi, who are descendants of the ancestral Puebloans or Anasazi, will say, no, we weren't forced to leave. We chose to leave. Our gods told us to leave. It was time to move on. It's pretty hard to argue with that.
But I've always wondered I'm going to call them the Anasazi, unless, okay, or the ancient ones or whatever. They had a rather sophisticated culture that included art, included, as I said, multi-story buildings, really sophisticated masonry. And the Hopi seem to be much more scaled down in their lives. Do people forget all the things that they knew when they were building a culture?
You're hitting on one of the crucial problems in Southwestern prehistory, which is that in historic times, after the Spanish arrived, we don't see anything like Chaco. We don't see anything like that hierarchical social structure. The Hopi, like all the other Pueblos, are very egalitarian, very democratic. Nobody stands out. And a number of archaeologists, especially Steve Lexon, who's my guru in all things Southwest, Lexon argues that today's Puebloans, like the folks who abandoned the Four Corners just before 1300, were repudiating Chaco. They were saying Chaco was a big deal, but it didn't work. It was bad. It ended up killing a lot of people, and we reject it and will forever reject it, hence the democratic, egalitarian nature of today's Pueblos.
Would the Anasazi have had a culture that was closer to what we have seen further south in Mexico? The Aztecs, et cetera?
Nothing quite as gaudy or kingly as Teotihuacan or Tenochtitlan or the Aztec Empire. You don't get those gigantic palatial civilizations, and yet Lexon again calls Chaco a kingdom and a palatial, and he calls the great houses palaces, much to the annoyance of his comrades, his colleagues. It's as I say, you're hitting on one of the really crucial questions and unsolved problems in Southwestern prehistory.
One of the other explanations I've heard for the reason for cliff dwellings and then the dissolution of the culture was that in praying for rain, certain rituals had to be observed, and when the rain didn't come, then a priest might say, well, you're doing it wrong, and then go off and start another group, another sect, and then they would all be at loggerheads with each other.
Right. And again, it's a great theory, yet it's very hard to test because we don't have any written records from back then. One theory that I espoused in the first book in 96 that's now pretty much debunked is that the folks up in the Four Corners got wind of what we'd now call the Kachina phenomenon, a whole new kind of religion down south. Mm-hmm. And since things weren't working up north, they said, let's go check out the Kachina cult or phenomenon. The problem is that we don't find any evidence of Kachina imagery before 1350 A.D. In other words, it's just 50 years, 70 years too late. So it could not have been the pole that drew them out of the Southwest. And my new book tries to correct the assumption I and most of the scholars made 20 years ago.
And the new book is called The Lost World of the Old Ones, Discoveries in the Ancient Southwest. It is published by Norton, and we're discussing the old ones on today's Please Explain and inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Frank from Copaig, Long Island, you're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? I just had a quick question for your guest. I'm not sure if you can answer, but I read something recently that was honestly kind of heartbreaking about construction sites. When I know there's legislation in place when you're digging in construction sites and you come across any archaeological finds that you need to report them, of course, so that they can, put the construction on hold and, discover everything, dig up everything, find out what maybe things that we've never found out before about different cultures. And from my understanding of it, a lot of times these construction companies, being that it puts them into difficult situations, extends their projects, they a lot of times don't disclose when they do find some of these, sites and things like that. And it's really heartbreaking that, things like that might happen, and we might never be able to recover some of the stuff that they might have found just because, it was more convenient for them to avoid reporting any of this. Does your guest have an opinion on that?
Yeah, David?
Yes, you make a very good point. Sadly, there's very little, it's both sadly and it's for a good reason. There's very little excavation going on today, except what we call salvage archaeology, when people are building a new road or a new subdivision, and they dig down and discover that the ancients were there before them.
But there are mounds. If you go to Mesa Verde, you see mounds that are obviously just begging to be excavated,
right.
And yet nobody is working on them.
Well, there's a kind of move away from invasive archaeology. The old cliche is that when you dig a site, you destroy it forever, so you better do it right. And increasingly in recent years, there have been attempts to do non-invasive archaeology, simply studying the surface and using things like ground-penetrating radar so that you don't destroy the site when you dig it. But as the caller suggests, every time they put in a new freeway or extension of the freeway in Tucson or Phoenix or Albuquerque, they'll come across ancient remains, and they're legally required to stop and report not only to the tribes that could be affiliated, but to responsible archaeologists before they proceed with the digging. And, of course, nobody on a construction gang wants to stop and observe that kind of nicety. So, yes, indeed, there are cases where people just plow ahead and destroy it forever.
Weren't a lot of sites destroyed by the archaeologists themselves in the past? Quite a few museums, like the American Museum of Natural History, pretty much plundered these sites.
Yeah. You look at the style and crudeness of early 20th century archaeology, even done by the so-called experts, the professionals, and some of it is pretty atrocious. Also, there's a phenomenon that plagues archaeology here and in other countries, is people who dig a site for 20 years and then never get around to writing it up. And that is really the most painful thing of all. There's so many cardinal examples of that, so that a major, major site like Yellow Jacket Ruin in southwestern Colorado will have 20 years of digging and no report ever published about it. It's essentially destroyed forever and lost.
You've said that some people treated your first book like a treasure map and went after a lot of the objects that you wrote about. Some people that actually warned you to keep quiet about what you had observed.
Yeah, that was sadly the most unexpected result of publishing my first book, which is that I naively described some of the great things I'd found, a pot on a ledge, an intact pot on a ledge in one canyon, a beautiful 1,500-year-old basket in another. And I included photographs, but I didn't even mention what canyon they were in. And I thought, well, this people will vicariously get a thrill out of seeing what I saw. They don't need to know where it is. But all kinds of people started showing up with my book at the Cedar Mesa Ranger Station saying, how do I get to Roberts's pot? Well, it wasn't Roberts's pot, obviously, but that created a backlash in which a lot of people, including the rangers, thought that I should have never written a book in the first place. And in part, the reason for writing my sequel is to argue why I do want to keep writing and talking and celebrating the ancients, even if it creates more attention than some people would like.
David Roberts is the author of 26 books about mountaineering, adventure, exploration, and Western history and anthropology. The one that is the basis for our discussion today on Please Explain is The Lost World of the Old Ones, Discoveries in the Ancient Southwest. It's published by Norton. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. And we are back with David Roberts. His latest book is The Lost World of the Old Ones, published by W.W. Norton. And we're talking about the old ones on today's Please Explain. Let's talk a bit about rock art, the pictographs. What kinds of things have you seen in your travels?
Rock art is the most tantalizing byproduct of the ancient civilizations because it's not a written language, though it is so provocative you start trying to decipher it. And since there is no continuous oral tradition leading into the present, we find these magnificent pictograph and petroglyph panels all over the Southwest, and we honestly don't know what they mean. It's a lost communication, not a language, but a some kind of statement about the lives of the ancients that we can only haphazard the most rudimentary guesses as to what it means.
But sometimes they're done in different styles, aren't they?
Well, yeah, we can classify the styles and we can date a lot of it to associated living sites. And experts such as Polly Schaffsma have done wondrous work in categorizing all the kinds of rock art all over the Southwest. And, you know, you can get so you can recognize Barrier Canyon style or Glen Canyon linear and realize that profound art traditions were wafting through these very, very separate communities of no larger than the extended family. You get very rigid artistic conventions that are stunning and beautiful. It's archaeologists tend to ignore rock art because they can't interpret it. And so it attracts the kind of the wackos and the new age crazies who have their own pat explanations for it. I try to resist that myself while still expressing my enthusiasm for it as art.
Some places like Desolation Canyon present what you call a conundrum for archaeologists because they contain a lot of rock art and many granaries, but almost no pottery. Archaeologists have to figure out what all of that means?
Exactly. We spent a 9-day rafting trip in Desolation a couple of years ago and found hundreds, maybe thousands of rock art images, and we found one piece of pottery. They simply weren't living there. So why are they spending so much time doing their art there? And we did find granaries, so they're storing their food. But we didn't find a single unmistakable living site in the whole 70, 80 miles of Desolation, nor have the archaeologists.
I spoke to some members of the Ute tribe about Mesa Verde, the UNESCO heritage site. They were furious that the U.S. government was able to acquire it, and they have maintained a number of sites without ever touching them. But in restoring Mesa Verde, was the do we get a distorted picture?
That's really interesting. Which Ute people were you talking to?
They had a similar site, actually, just a little further down, closer to the Four Corners area.
The Ute Mountain Tribal Park.
Excuse me?
The Ute Mountain Tribal Park.
Probably. This was years ago. Remember thinking, gee, this is really dangerous walking along these very narrow paths. The people who lived here must have been really very sure-footed.
Well, exactly. I mean, actually, the tribal park you're speaking of is contiguous with Mesa Verde on the south, so it's all one phenomenon. But if you want to see ruins without hordes of people, just go to Tewak and drive east along the Mancos River and take a Ute guide and let him show you ruins that'll blow your mind. They're understandably furious, and in fact, in the early years of reconstructing the ruins in Mesa Verde, there was some really crude and heavy-handed work done, so that, sadly, a place like Cliff Palace today really doesn't look like it looked in the 13th century. It's been overinterpreted, and again, that's the kind of thing that can never be recovered or redone.
A caller has asked about the Puebloans' power structure. How were they organized?
Well, for the most part, they were organized as they are today, in very simple egalitarian lines, with perhaps an elected leader, a governor today in the Pueblos. But as we were talking about Chaco earlier, most of the archaeologists see Chaco as a very stratified society with kings and rulers and peons and vassals, almost like an empire. That lasted only about 150 years at its peak, and which was then rejected as bad juju. But for the most part, throughout southwestern prehistory, we don't see a lot. It's the opposite of Egypt with the kings and the pyramids. It's very, very egalitarian and democratic.
We have a call from Mark from Chelsea. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Lenny. Listen, I have two short questions. One is there a connection between the rise of the Aztec culture, which I believe began in the early 14th century, and the migration from the Southwest. I spent a lot of time out there. And also, what about linguistic evidence of movements of people?
Two very good questions. It's pretty hard to prove any direct Aztec connection. It's actually more Toltec, who preceded the Aztecs, who are contemporary with the what we're calling the Anasazi. However, Aztecs themselves have an oral tradition of a place called Aztlan, the homeland in the north, and that may very well have overlapped with places like Mesa Verde and Chaco. As to the second question about linguistic diversity, that too is one of the true enigmas of the Southwest, because we've got 21 pueblos today in New Mexico, Arizona, and one in Texas near El Paso. And among those 21 pueblos, they speak six different languages and six different language groups with some dozen different languages. And
totally
some
different
of the languages, such as Zuni, are complete isolates, like related to no other language in the world.
Hmm.
So the great puzzle is, if these were one people, the ancestral Puebloans, why did they speak so many different languages, mutually unintelligible? Nobody's begun to solve this question.
I understand that some things have shown up on some of the sites that would suggest there was trade with people from the South, like abalone shells and
right.
other sorts of things. So there must have been contact, even if they didn't adopt each other's cultures.
We know there was trade. I mean, you find macaws from Mexico at Chaco, and, as you say, shells from the Pacific, and copper bells. So absolutely there was trade. The question is, was it simply trade, or was it actually the importation of whole ideas of how to live one's life? And that's a much murkier business, and still very controversial.
Now, archaeologists have theories. What about the people who live there today, like the Hopi, or the people who live in the area where the Fremont people used to be?
Well, again, you're asking very good questions. One big difference between the Hopi with respect to the Anasazi and the Fremont is that we have no evidence of any descendants from the Fremont. The Fremont truly seem to have disappeared. Not so the Anasazi. We do know the Anasazi became, in some form, today's Puebloans. But what happened to the Fremont? They're gone forever. Although there are people who would like to, there are experts who would like to link them with even such tribes as the Kiowa out on the Kansas Plains. Everything you're raising points to so far unresolved and possibly insoluble questions, but all the more intriguing because of it.
A listener, Mason, wonders if it's possible that the old ones were exposed to some other people who brought a disease that destroyed their group. He's thinking of something like the smallpox that the Europeans brought when they came to the Americas. I realize the Europeans would not have been in contact with the Anasazis, but perhaps it was another Native American group. The Apache were coming down into this territory around that time.
Right. There's no great evidence of a huge plague or epidemic until you get the Spanish, and then it's devastating. Smallpox, influenza, measles, everything. It really took European germs to wipe out most of the American Indians. But there were certainly cultural conflicts embodied in the advent of Apaches, Navajos, Utes, Shoshone, Comanche, nomads, after the Spanish, horseback riding nomads who raided and attacked for centuries the Pueblos and who were linguistically and culturally completely different from them. I don't think a major plague or epidemic, however.
A listener wondered about the stories that she'd heard about cannibalism in the area.
Yeah, cannibalism is now a demonstrable fact, and thanks especially to Christy Turner, a great physical anthropologist from Arizona who documented scores of cases of irrefutable cannibalism. Nobody wanted to believe this because it didn't jibe with the idea of the noble savage, but it's now irrefutably proved. And the great question is, it doesn't seem to have been survival cannibalism, hunger cannibalism, like the Uruguayan rugby team in Alive, but rather ritual cannibalism to scare the dickens out of the people you were subjugating. In other words, you killed, dismembered, and then ate them just to intimidate them, not because you were hungry. And that is such a dark image that people today are still having trouble living with it. And in fact, the Puebloans pretty much deny it.
Just this week, the Associated Press reported that archaeologists found evidence of corn farming from 1,500 years ago in southern Utah. Was corn the major crop there? You were talking about the granaries. What other things were they growing?
Well, you're pointing out something, that corn keeps getting pushed back and back in the Southwest. It used to be thought that it didn't arrive until 200 AD, and now we've got it well back before the time of Christ. Corn unmistakably came from Mexico. I mean, in Mexico, it goes back to 7,000 years. But it took a long time for the idea of corn to filter up to this much more northern part of the North America. And corn was the great staple until relatively late, like 700, 800 AD, when it's supplemented by beans and squash. That triad, corn, beans, and squash, was the lifeblood of all the ancient ones until after the time of contact. There was hunting, there was big game, but that wasn't the main source of food.
Now, one other question, because we're running out of time. John called to ask about genetic testing on the ancient Puebloans. Do we have any genetic material that we can test against modern tribes?
Some people would like to, but you could not have picked a time in American history when it is less likely to win the cooperation of a Native American group to submit to DNA testing just to prove that they were related to somebody prehistoric. That just won't go down today. And their recalcitrance in the face of that is well earned. You know, in the early 20th century, guys like Herdlichka were digging up cemeteries just to sample the crania. So today's Native Americans don't want any part of that kind of genetic testing. And so even though it could be tremendously fruitful, it's not going to happen.
But museums took some of those skeletons. Again, I mentioned the American Museum of Natural History, which desecrated graves and destroyed pottery and carted tons of stuff across the country to stick in their basement. Wouldn't they have some material there that they could use?
Yes, but how are you going to compare that to living groups today unless you...
Oh, they won't. They won't participate.
Now, it's a very good summation of the early years of the AMNH, unfortunately.
Are you going back soon?
Oh, I can't wait to go back. Every spring and fall, I have to go out there because there's so much more to see. I mean, there's so many canyons I've never been in.
And then some of them only reachable. I once went to Keith Seal on horseback because there was no way to get there otherwise. It's fascinating, but riding isn't something that my body isn't ready to do again. David Roberts, his latest book is The Lost World of the Old Ones, Discoveries of the Ancient Southwest. It is published by W.W. Norton. And David, thank you so much for participating in today's Please Explain.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.